Hi, I'm Mark Brody, and this is the Friday Newscap Podcast. Each week, we review the biggest stories with experts, reporters, and commentators to put the news in perspective. Here's this week's episode. But first, it is time for the Friday Newscap and some voices from the news this week.
There's a lot of work to be done, and it's not going to happen in that chamber for 2 hours when the president's just going to be using, that bully pulpit as a way to just, push further and further his agenda.
Sort of saying, here's why so much of the execution of the agenda is so difficult. So in many ways, it was more than just the issue. It was actually demonstrating the differences.
We have become a laughingstock when it comes to elections. And these small steps are steps that we can take to instill trust back into our elections.
More than 20 schools were closed for a day. Tens of thousands of students were sent home. And parents were left scrambling for childcare.
If I, as a teacher, take a day off and go to a protest and my students see, wow, my teacher is willing to take her sick time to go stand up for my community, to me, I'm proud of that.
These vaccines work. They are safe. And the science behind them is overwhelming.
And joining me to talk about what's in a name when it comes to a political party, reaction to this week's State of the Union, and more are Doug Cole of High Ground. Good morning, Doug.
Good morning, Mark.
And Gael Esposito of Creosote Partners. Gael, good morning to you.
Good morning to you, too.
So let's start with the State of the Union. Not so much what the president said, but the fact that some members of Arizona's delegation were there, some were not. Gael, a lot of Democrats stayed away. We heard from Senator Gallego just a moment ago. Senator Mark Kelly, though, notably was there. I'm curious what you make of the decision of should I stay or should I go?
Yeah, I mean, I think when we look at this decision of staying or going, we really saw with the president's speech a justification of why they should not have been there. Too many games, too much childish, pathetic actions from the president with stand for this, don't stand for that. It was a clown show, really. And so I think there was a lot of justification for the members who decided not to. And for the ones who did, even more power to them for being able to stomach that.
What do you think, Doug?
Well, I think they missed a big opportunity because it was a medal fest. I mean, we had gold medals. We had the Medal of Freedom. We had the Medal of Honor. We had the Purple Heart. I mean, everybody had medals at that State
of
the
Union.
It's
like Oprah was there or something.
Yeah, it was great. I was going to give away a car. But it's part of the showmanship that the State of the Union has turned into. And when there's a Democrat president and the Republicans walk out and protest and yell inappropriately, okay, that's and conversely, Democrats did the same thing on Tuesday night. Some did and walked out when they had unveiled their folded signs. And that's just – this is what the State of the Union has turned into. It used to be a very solemn event, didn't last more than, say, 40, 45 minutes. Now it's I feel sometimes like it's we're in the Kremlin and or in North Korea, and we just have to listen to nearly 2 hour speeches.
Does this like resonate? Like, Gael, you mentioned sort of the games, and Doug, you referenced showmanship. Like, does this resonate with voters? Whether people stood when the president said stand, or if they clapped long enough for the hockey team. Like, do actual voters care about this?
No. I can't imagine that they do. I think it shows how far we've devolved and how much this has just become Donald Trump's newest reality TV show. It's not about the things that impact people's lives, and they're tired of it.
Look, he needed a reset. I don't know if he accomplished that. I mean, we're going to very contentious midterm elections here, and history points to that the party that controls all three branches, the House, the Senate, not all mm-hmm. three branches, but House, Senate, and the White House, does not do well. I mean, history is pretty clear on that. I mean, there's like one or two exceptions in the last 100 years of that. So the Republican Party is facing headwinds, and I think a lot of people were looking forward to a bit of a reset. I think there was an attempt for that, but I don't think he landed it.
All right. So speaking of what might be coming in November, the midterm elections, obviously, a little bit of news this week on some of those races in Arizona. Gail, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee put two Democratic challengers into their what's called red to blue list, which is trying to turn districts currently held by Republicans to Democrats. The first one is Joanna Mendoza in the 6th Congressional District. That's Southern Arizona, the seat currently held by Juan Ciscomani. Also, Jonathan Nez, who ran 2 years ago in the 2nd District. That's the seat currently held by Eli Crane, sort of in the northern part of Arizona.
About the size of Indiana, that
it's
district
a, you put
is.
A lot of miles on yeah. your car yeah. or your truck campaigning in that district. I'm curious. It seems like, you know, both – Nez, you know, overperformed, I think, some Democratic goals in 2024, but still lost pretty handily. Like, is that specifically a race you think Democrats realistically can win?
I think when we look at the results of the special elections that have been taking place, we're seeing crazy overperformance among Democratic candidates. And so I think this really shows the environment that the party thinks they're walking into this coming November, that they're putting Nez on this list. And yes, he did really overperform in the last election. And so I think there is a justification for doing it, especially in this environment.
Of the two, do you think one has a better chance to not just make it through the primary, but actually win in November?
I think Ciscomani's in real trouble. And I think we can really see that based on some of the actions he's taken by embracing far-right figures instead of giving up on this performative centrism that he used to at least try to nominally accomplish when he first ran. I think really he knows he's in danger and is looking to what comes after.
What do you think?
The power of incumbency is enormous. He's already won re-election there. I disagree. I don't think that. Everybody's in danger, but I think that he's going to pull it off. I think Eli Crane, you know, that's really two districts. Okay,
you have, just in terms of size.
But the North is Native American lands, which he will do well in as the former president.
Jonathan Nez.
Of the Navajo Nation, and then you have the South, which is the White Mountain area, which is extremely – I mean, we have that Trump store in Sholo, okay? I mean,
yeah.
That is extremely red. And I must – you know, how Congressman Crane votes in D.C. and who he aligns himself with, yeah, I mean, you know, it's very MAGA and it's very, you know, Freedom Caucus-ish. But he is well known in the district for his constituent services. And he's there every weekend. And he works that district hard. So, you know, it's I think we'll see an overperformance by the former chairman of the president of the Navajo Nation. But I see that seat, CD2, staying red also.
Do you see – you said you see Ciscomani pulling it out. Do you see it as a close race or maybe even closer than it was 2 years ago?
I think so. It's going to be highly competitive. There's going to be a ton of money poured in there. So the TV stations in Tucson are going to just have great years in ad revenue.
Okay, so another super competitive race in Arizona, the 1st Congressional District, yeah. That's sort of East Valley, the seat that David Schweikert currently has. He's, of course, leaving to run for governor. Doug, your firm put out a poll this week on the Democratic primary that showed there are two candidates who ran before, Amish Shah and Marlene Galán Woods. Shah won 2 years ago, and your poll has him up big again.
Big. I think that race is our conclusion was, even though there's still 49% undecided in that race, with the lead that former state representative Amish Shah has, roughly 35-11, if I remember correctly. Even if all the undecideds would happen to go to the other candidates or other candidate, it's still a number that I don't think can be overcome. I think the Democratic Party would be good to consolidate in that race at this point and focus on the general election because they need 100,000 independents. They need the Democrats to stay tight with their candidate, and they need roughly 100,000 independents to vote Democratic for the Democratic candidate in order to be successful in CD1.
Gail, do the results surprise you at all?
I mean, Amish Shah is the only one who has spent money recently. You know, he was the candidate last time around. He was on TV for a very long time. So it doesn't surprise me to see him slightly ahead at this point. I do have to wonder what the good folks running the Arizona Independent Party have an interest in who the Democratic nominee is in CD1 here with high ground there. But
wait a minute. We have nothing to do with the Arizona Independent Party. So, Gael, that is inaccurate.
Oh, okay.
Very inaccurate.
Very inaccurate. Okay, yeah. That's good to know. So I'm very interested in what this will end up being in the end with Shaw having been the one who has spent so far. But really, at 32%, was that right?
Yeah, in the 30s. Yeah, 30,
yeah. I still think there's a lot of room for this to change.
Do you have do you think he would be the strongest general election candidate? Obviously, we don't know who's going to come out on the Republican side. Jay Feely and State Representative Joseph Chaplick are in that race. But do you have a sense at this point of who might be the strongest candidate for Democrats to win a seat that they probably need to win to take control of Congress?
I think the strongest candidate is going to be the one who makes it out of the primary. I'm a big believer that, you know, if you can't do it in the primary, you weren't the strongest candidate at the end of the day. So I think we'll wait and see, but we've got a good feel there.
Doug, let me start with you with some legislative stuff going on.
Sure.
We've avoided the legislature so far during this segment.
I can't avoid it as a lobbyist.
No, I don't think either of you can really avoid it at this point.
Badly.
So, Doug, the State House this week approved a measure to ask voters to basically do away with voting centers and require in-person precinct voting. Voting centers where you can go anywhere in the county and they look up where you live. They print out the ballot specific to where you live and you can go pretty much anywhere. Is this something that voters would support?
I don't think so. Maricopa County has done a fantastic job of opening up access to voting with these voting centers, and they've been wildly popular. This is a referral to the ballot by Representative Ketchel from down in northern Pima County. And her proposal, what it does is it as you said, gets rid of voting centers and goes back to precincts that would have no more than 2,500 members in each precinct. Okay, well, let's do a little bit of math on the back of a napkin. There are 2.6 million registered voters in Maricopa County. Do that math. That would be 1,040 precincts just in Maricopa County.
Hmm.
Think about – I don't think there's enough churches, schools, women's clubs, you name it, and enough people in Maricopa County to not only locate it, that many precincts, but also to staff them.
Mm.
So these voting centers have been very, very, very productive. And there's been glitches in the past with some printers that didn't print dark enough, et cetera. But I think those have been worked out. People are used to it. They're used to going, you know, showing up a week before the election if they, you know, want to go in. So they've been very, very, very good. But let's think about moving forward here. Even if we do go to a precinct-based system, the ballots keep getting longer and longer. This last general election was two pieces of paper, four sides. Now, that usually takes an average voter 15 to 20 minutes to a half hour if they have to read everything to vote. Think about the lines. It's just really mostly untenable. And I don't quite understand why the Republican leadership would move this forward, because I think if you did a poll on that right now, I think it'd be wildly unpopular.
Kyle, I want to ask you why Republican leadership at the legislature let this go forward. But it's interesting. I mean, to Doug's point, a lot of people, those who vote in person, a lot of them vote at voting centers. They can vote early. They can show up to sort of take their time there. I'm curious, like, what do you think might be behind this, especially as Doug said, it doesn't seem like it would be something that voters would be overwhelmingly supportive of.
I mean, they tell us they want to make it harder for people to vote. They want fewer people voting. They want to control that electorate in that way. And they want to do this not just by this precinct model, but by ending mail-in voting, by ending early voting. They want to make it harder. And I think that is one of the biggest divides between the parties right now, is that you have the Democratic Party that wants to make it easier and the Republican Party that wants to make it harder. And right now with this vote center model, people are able, you know, people who commute long distances are able to go to whatever voting center is closest by, wherever they are at that time, to be able to vote. now we're going to be punishing these folks who have these long drives, who need to make it back, to then just wait in line for hours and hours to vote in one of these precinct models. I don't think voters are going to buy it. And I think the Republican Party's whole philosophy around voting rights is one that voters will reject and have rejected and will continue to reject.
Well, there were over 100 SCRs and HCRs introduced in this session. Ballot referrals by the legislature. They've already approved two or three from last session. You know, you get ballot fatigue, and what's going to make it at the end of the day? Okay, made it out of the House. Lots of press releases came out this week over this issue, lauding it, making it out of the House. Let's see at the end of the day what really makes it on the ballot.
Well, and Gail, that's kind of the question, right? Because last cycle, there were a number of legislative referrals, in part because the governor doesn't have a say in them. They can sort of pass what they want, see what the voters will approve without having to worry about Governor Hobbs vetoing it. Does this seem like another cycle where we might be just getting almost like throwing it up against the wall and seeing what voters will approve, whether or not you have a campaign pro or con?
Yeah, I think they want to see how many they can sneak past the goalposts. Luckily, voters pay a lot of attention to these sorts of ballot referrals. I think it's equivalent to the top of the ticket, and they take this responsibility very seriously. And so I think when you see Republicans throwing up these crazy ideas, these radical ideas, that you're going to see voters reject them wholeheartedly, no matter how many they add to the ballot. And so I think it's a terrible strategy for them. It's one that voters will see through. I think it'll harm them in the end.
But what's interesting is, you know, last cycle we had the abortion issue, the Prop 139, and Prop 140, the open primaries deal, one passed, one went down. There really is no citizens initiative big driver out there this year. So it's all the referrals at this point.
I mean, there's the potential of the ESA.
Potential.
We'll see if they collect the signatures.
Yeah,
make
but
it
it's
ballot.
Not
yeah.
the buzz. This time 2 years ago, that's what we were talking about,
right?
Those two things.
Doug, let me stick with you and ask about a measure going through. This is not a ballot referral. It's just a bill going through the legislature that would force Gail brought up the Arizona Independent mm-hmm. Party earlier. It would force that party to change its name, basically saying, here are a list of words you cannot have in the name of a party, independent being one of them. Supporters are saying this is confusing both political parties. The Clean Elections Commission have sued to try to get the former No Labels Party to change its name. Is this something that sort of in the political world, it seems like it has a lot of support? I wonder, like in sort of the real world, if it would also have that amount of support.
Well, realistically, there's really been only two issues that both the governor, the House, and the Senate have agreed upon this session that, by my estimation, one of them is the Colorado River reallocation.
Money for a lawsuit.
Yeah. And the philosophy of the lower basin states staying with each other, fighting the upper basin states. So it's been kumbaya on that. And this is the other issue, is doing a retroactive bill that would forbid the Arizona Independent Party that's headed by Paul Johnson, the former Phoenix mayor. They already have gubernatorial candidates announcing they want to run, of using the word independent in their name. I think that bill, it's being run by the president pro tem, T.J. Shope, and came out of committee from Annalise Ortiz to the far right, Freedom Caucus members voting for it. So it came out unanimously. I think it's going to hit the governor's desk and then the question becomes, you know, how valid is the retroactivity clause in it?
Yeah, it seems like there might be some challenges to this. I mean, Gail, should the Democrats and Republicans be concerned that it is confusing that there is an Arizona Independent Party?
Yeah, I mean, for the purposes of voter registration, it is confusing. When voters are marking down that they're independent, they're declaring their independence from the political party system more often than not. And right now, where do those voters go? Do they go to the Arizona Independent Party? Are they that party not declared? You know, what did they intend? I think it's purposefully very confusing, and I think that's what the leaders of this party intended.
And it's all an outgrowth that non-Democrat, non-Republicans, non-Green must have, you know, 6 to 8 times more signatures just to get on the ballot mm-hmm. for ballot access. So I think this is the continuing debate. Now, Prop 140 went down by the voters in last general election. But the problem still persists that a third of Arizonans are not party designated, and it's about ballot access at the end of the day. So we're going to be talking about this for a long time.
Yeah, I'm curious, Gail, if you think, I mean, obviously, as Doug said, Republicans and Democrats at the legislature seem supportive of it. There's some talk that the governor, if it gets to her, would likely sign it. Is this the kind of thing that you could see lawsuits that maybe drag into election season? And maybe there's even more confusion about what this party can and cannot be called and who's a member of it.
Yeah, I think we're going to continue to see lawsuits over this. And I think that confusion is damaging and unhelpful. And I think, you know, they are right to pursue this change still. Like this is something that has already caused problems. And I think the Clean Elections Commission being engaged on it really demonstrates the nonpartisan concerns that exist there. And I think something has to be done.
And remember, the Secretary of State allowed it to happen. So
He said he didn't have a choice.
Yeah, he didn't have a choice. Yeah.
He didn't, yeah.
Okay, interesting. Lots more to come on that, no doubt. Gael Esposito, Doug Cole, thanks to both for the conversation. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Mark.
You've been listening to the Friday Newscap from KJZZ's The Show. It's an original podcast recapping the week's biggest stories with experts, commentators, and reporters. You can get the full show podcast at podcast.kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening.